Welcome to Roots Runners Rhizomes. This is Sarah Faulkner. My co-host Lauren Jambroni cannot be here today. She'll be back with us in July. And we are speaking today with Elliot Tokar. Elliot is a traditional Tibetan medicine doctor and internationally experienced writer and lecturer. He currently practices Tibetan medicine in New York City. He was one of the first Westerners to have received extensive textual and clinical training in this ancient medical discipline. He began his studies in 1983 with Dr. Yeshi Donden. From 1986, he was apprenticed to Dr. Trogawa Rinpoche, both of who were founders of His Holiness the Dalai Lama's Tibetan Medical Institute Mensikong in Dharamsala, India. Elliot's also studied with numerous other Tibetan doctors and has additionally trained in aspects of traditional Chinese and Japanese medicine. Dr. Tokar has lectured and been affiliated with many institutions, including Yale University, Princeton University, U of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, Washington University School of Medicine, and so forth. His publications have appeared in American and international journals. And he's a very esteemed and respected practitioner of traditional Tibetan medicine, which we're going to talk about on the show today. So, Elliot, welcome to the show.
Hi, Sarah. It's good to speak with you and to your listeners.
Likewise. Thanks for coming on the show. So maybe if we want to begin, can you tell us a little bit about your background, where you're from, and how you first encountered Tibetan medicine and started on your path as a practitioner?
Well, I suppose I'm one of the rare native New Yorkers around these days and back in New York for many years and practicing here. How I encountered Tibetan medicine and started practicing it was a bit common in the earlier phase of people training and learning and becoming interested in traditional forms of natural medicine, which is, I say, takes us back to the very early 80s. Mm-hmm. I was in college at the time. I was living in Massachusetts, and I had a friend who I'd met who had actually come here, emigrated from Brazil, and she was suffering from a very long-term set of infectious disease problems, was very debilitated by this. And it was a sort of unusual illness where she'd suffer from these quite significant infectious diseases for periods of months, then go through periods of latency where there was nothing diagnosable in biomedical terms, and then get really sick again. Mm. And initially, when she had a reoccurrence, the last time it was a disease called osteomyelitis, which is a somewhat rare illness your listeners might not know about, but it's a very virulent bone infection, which is not only dangerous, but creates enormous amounts of physical pain. Mm-hmm. We initially took her to a hospital out in Boston, Tufts University, mm-hmm. and met what at that time was one of the only infectious disease experts at the hospital, that is someone who was expert in tuberculosis. You know, nowadays there's more tuberculosis in the States than there was back then. But, you know, at that time it was a fairly rare disease in America. Mm-hmm. And he told us that she needed 9 months in hospital with surgery and medication, et cetera.
Wow.
Now, just previous to that, before she'd gotten ill, we had gotten the diagnosis from a traditional Japanese medicine practitioner who's based in New York, or was based in New York. And she gave quite a different prescription, one relating to changes in diet and certain kinds of home remedies. Now, as I said, my friend was sick for many years. It was actually the seventh year of her illness. And in the hospital, having to decide whether to stay another 9 months in hospital, I basically asked her what she wanted to do. And she said, you know, I've been through this for many, many years in two countries now, and I just can't take these kinds of treatments anymore. Let's go home and try this other approach. Now, this was a very daring thing to do, because even getting her to the hospital took several people helping her get into the car to drive up to Boston. Mm. And so she was in a lot of pain, very debilitated, but nevertheless, she made this choice. And it was, I suppose, daring for us to take her up on the choice as well. And we brought her back to Boston, and we started working in a mode which was based largely on the macrobiotic system, which nowadays is not so much in vogue, but at the time was very important in natural medicine in America.
Mm-hmm.
And it was mainly based on the precepts of traditional East Asian medicine, based on Japanese system, although adapted as such. And over a period of 3 months, with implementing dietary precisions and also doing specific kinds of home remedies, physical remedies, slowly she went from being in pain for 24 hours a day to it being tolerable, to it being less. And basically at the end of the 3 months, all the visible symptoms or the discernible symptoms of the osteomyelitis had declined, which is quite amazing. I mean,
yeah.
In subsequent years, I talked to a number of biomedical doctors, and just by pure coincidence, a number of them said to me they were convinced that one illness you couldn't treat with natural medicine was osteomyelitis, just pulling it out of their hat as a rare illness they thought perhaps I wasn't aware of.
Wow.
And of course, this was my first experience with natural medicine. Now, after that 3 months, my friend had gotten at least over the symptoms of this dangerous illness, but was still trapped in the same syndrome that she previously had been, as I described it. And at the time, like I said, I was living in Amherst, Massachusetts, and the former physician of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Dr. Yeshe Dandan, who's a very famous Tibetan doctor, still practicing in his, I believe, 80s or 90s in India, used to come yearly to Amherst to visit an academician who was working there, Robert Thurman. And we decided to see him. Now, I was a fairly skeptical person. I wasn't someone who was interested in New Age things or, just alternative things for the sake of it, or particularly fascinated with Orientalism or things of that type. So I did a lot of research into who Dr. Dandan was, and I was lucky at that time the New York Times had run an article about him in the magazine, of all places, and we decided to go see him. And in the consultation, what was most fascinating is his diagnosis, although different from the Japanese doctors, was very much in parallel with it.
Mm.
And we described what we had done at that point, and he approved and recommended the addition of Tibetan herbal medicines. And we implemented that. And so in another 3 months, my friend was, back to normal health. I mean, for example, she had suffered from rheumatoid arthritis, and her, I believe, left hand had withered quite a bit. She didn't have much use of it. She regained much of the use of her hand, was able to, get around, wasn't constantly ill, was able to gain weight. And so what I understood from that was that we were dealing with something that was really medicine, that was really, in a sense, that medicine is at all a science-based, meaning systematic. And for a number of personal intellectual reasons, I decided the rather crazy idea of trying to study Tibetan medicine, which even now is very difficult. Back then was basically impossible. But Dr. Dandan had decided to start teaching a course in Amherst initially to try to train Western people. It was something, the first time that was ever done internationally. And we started out with, I think, 12 folks. The first year it sort of ballooned up to about 25 by the third year. But then, in the end, I was the last one left standing, which is a testament to my doggedness or how impractical I am. I'm not quite sure. Nevertheless, in 1984, I met who came to be my main teacher, Dr. Trogawa Rinpoche, who was both a Tibetan Lama or Buddhist teacher and practitioner, and also a very famous physician. He and Dr. Dandan had actually, as you said in the credit, been two of the people, among the people who restarted Tibetan Medical Institute, which is located in Lhasa in Tibet, restarted it in the exile community in India. And in fact, you can see some video of them teaching back in the 60s online in what started to be a very small, very primitive setup in Dharamsala in India in the 60s, which now has grown into a large, very substantial institution.
So I'm just going to interject too. I'm sure we have some listeners who maybe aren't familiar with the Tibetan political situation, which that's not the primary reason we're doing this show today, but if you could just say how and when Tibetans came to be living in exile in India.
Well, in the 50s, there was a geopolitical shift in Asia. Of course, the Chinese Communist Party had taken control earlier in China. And over the centuries, Tibet and other areas of the Himalayas had been, you know, independent or controlled by India or controlled by China. Borders shifted as they had in Europe, you know, throughout history. And at that particular point in time, China took claim to Tibet, and there was a military incursion. And the Tibetan, a large amount of the Tibetan government as it existed at that point, exiled to India, including the Dalai Lama. Many Tibetans also exiled themselves into India, Bhutan, Nepal, Sikkim, and those areas. And so with that having happened, a lot of the major Tibetan institutions, monasteries that held various Buddhist religious lineages, obviously the medicine, the structures that taught medicine, the colleges that taught medicine, other political and social institutions were recreated in South Asia. And so in the hill station of Dharamsala in the village of McLeod Ganj up in the mountains, the Dalai Lama was settled. And that's where his, what he considered to be government in exile, was recreated. And also the Tibetan Medical Institute was recreated by, as I said, Dr. Dun and Dr. Trigao and a small number of others. And this was quite an amazing kind of effort, because not only were there the physical rigors of exile, and we know there's a lot in the news nowadays about people being refugees and the difficulties of being refugees. And so this is something that we're thinking a lot about currently. So, you know, a refugee population has enormous challenges facing it in many ways. But additionally, you have to think that, you know, the climate and environs of Tibet and the climate environs, even in the northern part of India, for the most part, are extremely different.
Mm-hmm.
So in, you know, recreating the medicine, not only did one have to create, you know, ways of teaching and have the right texts and get students and provide all those things you need for education, but in some way Tibetan medicine, and we'll get a little bit more into the integrative nature of Tibetan medicine, what it also had to do is face the challenge of seeing whether it can operate outside of its normal cultural milieu. You know, mm-hmm. when you think about Chinese medicine or Ayurveda or other systems of traditional Asian medicine, they're often very much, conditioned by existing largely in their place of origin. And Tibetan medicine was quite, advantaged, because it's a synthesis of the Indian system with influences from the Persian and Greek system and some minor influences in the Chinese system. It has a certain kind of flexibility to it.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, moving to India was a great physical and cultural challenge for those Tibetans who left after the Chinese incursion. But it was also an enormous challenge for Tibetan doctors to see how to readapt their system of medicine to a completely different climate and environment. You know, diet,
yes.
of course, was different. All these things were different. And in a way, that's a real test of the medical system, because in a way, you know, within any culture, there are certain things that are practiced or believed in or done or passed down that are, you know, largely cultural structures.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other things that have more universal meaning, and medicine, of course, has to have that kind of universal meaning. So luckily, those Tibetan doctors who went into South Asia were able to successfully rebuild the educational institutions and also create the progress in their field such that they could continue to make the medicines they needed to treat both the illnesses that they were traditionally treating in Tibet, but also the new kinds of problems and illnesses that they saw in India. Because don't forget, also a lot of the Tibetan population that came into India were settled in the south, where it was even hotter and the climate was even more different.
Right.
So then when, in a way, when Tibetan medicine, both centuries ago and more recently, migrated west, initially into Eastern Europe, and then more recently, let's say, as far as the United States, you know, this idea of adapting both diagnosis and treatment and view of pathology, physiological effects of climate, diet, etc. There was this great kind of flexibility that was built into the system and already tested in the early 60s when the Tibetan exile into South Asia occurred.
And that that whole experience will serve us well as Tibetan medicine flourishes here in the United States, which we'll be talking about a little later, too.
Yes, but very much so.
So to get back to, I think I last left you when I interrupted you, you were speaking about how you...
Oh, my life story.
Yes, your life story. So you studied with Dr. Dondon in Amherst, and then what?
Well, in 1984, I had heard about Dr. Trungpa Rinpoche and was invited to meet him, and I did. And I basically explained to him what I'd done to that point, not necessarily expecting much, but he immediately sort of encouraged me to start studying with him. And it was quite an amazing situation, because I found out subsequently that Dr. Trungpa was not even really taking Tibetan students at that time. He had one other senior Western student who was really his translator. Besides that, he wasn't really teaching. And so the fact that he made this offer to me was quite incredible in retrospect. And then when he came back to the States about a year later, he recontacted me and reminded me of that commitment he had made to me and I'd made to him. And I got going with my studies. And as I said, in a sense, I've been enormously privileged to have the opportunity to do this kind of study, which was largely unprecedented. I mean, in the generation that I'm coming from, the number of Western people, meaning, you know, anybody who's, not Tibetan, who studied Tibetan medicine with actual Tibetan masters, is a very minute amount. I mean, you can count really on one hand easily. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that I had the privilege to study with these great physicians and have an opportunity to sit with them and be with them in clinic and learn from them was a great privilege. And to this day, I'm not quite sure how I ended up in that position, but nevertheless, that's the story.
That's awesome. Can you tell us what the typical training would have been before or is at this time in different places where Tibetan and Himalayan peoples are living, whether in exile or in places like Bhutan or Nepal?
Sure. Well, basically, you have two basic systems of training. The more traditional one, of course, was through family or apprenticeship lineages, and that existed largely for centuries. And then in Tibet, in the 17th century, the first medical school was started, Chakpori in Lhasa, which was on a hill across from the famous Potala or Palace of the Dalai Lama. And later in the 20th century, this Menzikang, the place that was recreated in India subsequently and still exists in Tibet, was created. And so you had basically three ways people studied: through family lineage, through apprenticeship lineage, and then through academic lineages. And that's largely how people still study today, although I will say that there is a bit of a crisis largely created by the hegemony of biomedicine, whether it's, you know, emanating from here or within the East, mm-hmm. where very too often nowadays, not just in Tibetan medicine, but in Ayurveda, in Chinese medicine, in various forms of medicine, the family and apprenticeship lineages, such as I come from, are largely under attack and being delegitimized. And there's a lot of push to sort of claim that only academic lineages are valid. For example, in Nepal, there's been a lot of stress around this for Ayurvedic practitioners. And like any subject, there's complexity to it. It's not just, you know, black and white. But when we think about traditional Asian medicine in any form, you have two components. You have the breadth of the system, meaning the number of kinds of diseases it can or illnesses it can treat, the extent to which it understands issues of health and illness and et cetera. Mm-hmm. That's one aspect. And then there's the depth, which is the various ways that it's practiced, the various systems that have been adapted from the centralized system, because all of these systems of medicine have certain basic components that are the same, much like biomedicine. You know, biomedicine, people tend to think of it as one thing, but the way biomedicine is practiced in America as opposed to Japan as opposed to Sweden mm-hmm. are not precisely the same. So there's that aspect of breadth. And then there are also, what to say, inventions and extensions and progress that have made in medicine in various locales or in various lineages or with various doctors doing their scientific and medical experimentation. And so that's where the depth is. So when you create a standardized, so-called standardized system of medicine, or you deem that only a certain way of studying is the only way to do it, often you can maintain a lot or all of the breadth, but the depth gets destroyed. And we have to very much think in the West, when we start thinking about medicine, and here, especially, let's say, in America, people are sensitive to the idea of when medicine is highly industrialized and the cost of that, and not just the financial cost, but the cost in terms of suffering or the ability to help people, we have to be a lot more careful and understand that, you know, medicine is a very complex and unique discipline, medicine overall. Very often Americans think that medicine is, for example, the same as science, and it is not and never has been, and no one in science or medicine who really understands it thinks that way. Medicine is a distinct kind of practice, and again, I'm speaking medicine overall, and within different systems of medicine, whether it's modern biomedicine or traditional forms of medicine, there's a lot of complexity to how the systems develop, how they practice, how they think of things. And again, it's very much based on education, on region, on experience of the individual doctors. Science is important in medicine, again, or traditional medicine or modern medicine, but it's in a way, it's an adjunct to it. So, for example, taking biomedicine as an example, whereas most people tend to think of it as purely scientific and based on research, only a small percent, only a very small percentage of it is. Most of it is based on the clinical experience of doctors, and that's how things move forward. Research is an important, tool of medicine, but it isn't the essence of how medicine is either done or taught or perpetuated. And there's argument about whether or not that's good or bad, and there's the whole new so-called evidence-based medicine movement, which is a whole discussion unto itself. But the fact is that that when you talk about medicine, you're talking about a unique field of a human endeavor, a unique field of human small s science, and we have to be very careful of the extent to which we preserve the knowledge that exists in medicine overall, as well as in specific systems such as Tibetan medicine.
So this is a huge question, but can you, for our listeners, give a kind of pithy overview of what's unique about Tibetan medicine, which also is called Soa Rigpa? You can maybe talk a little bit about that and sort of describe how it differs from other systems of medicine.
Well, nowadays, in so-called alternative medicine or natural medicine, the term integrative is a common term of parlance. And again, talking about what's meant in America by integrative medicine is a separate discussion, but this is a term that's used. But what does it really mean for a system of medicine to be integrative? Well, Tibetan medicine really gives the true depiction of that. Of course, you know, Tibetans had some of their own ideas about medicine and healing, like all ancient people. But then at the beginning of the 4th century, a lot of ideas started to disseminate into Tibet from other areas surrounding it. Ideas coming from India, and as I implied before, over the centuries later from Persia, from the Unani system of medicine, from Greece, from Galen medicine. And then around the 7th to 8th century, the Tibetan government actually began sponsoring conferences where doctors skilled in these various medical systems, China, Persia, India, Greece, etc., would come into the country and share their knowledge. And the debates, which was a typical form of intellectual exchange in the ancient world, and essentially people who were able to win, let's say, in these debates were seen as having real knowledge. And the Tibetans, as they did with Buddhism and other aspects of their culture, were quite open into drawing information from other cultures and create something new from it. And so these ideas were occurring, this valuing of medical pluralism was quite real. And over the time, a unique system was codified. And around the 11th century, that's when a lot of the codification of what now we consider to be Tibetan medicine occurred. And the main four texts of Tibetan medicine were written starting in the 11th century. And so when people study Tibetan medicine, what they're really getting is this wonderful synthesis of the, in a way, the best of a lot of the medicine of the ancient world, or at least the ancient world as it dealt with the way that information often disseminated in those periods in history throughout Asia, and then Greece is the link to the West. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, Tibetan medicine is a unique, coherent system. We can say that Tibetan medicine is not Chinese medicine. It is not Ayurveda. It is not Unani. But at the same time, it has very clear and positive links and inspirations from all those other systems. And so in our modern world, when we start to talk about integrative medicine, it's my opinion that we have to be a lot more serious rather than just sort of talking about some kind of, stew, where mm-hmm. you just sort of throw lots of things in a pot, or a hospital center where you have a chiropractor and a Reiki specialist and what have you. We have to really try to value what I mentioned before, which is medical pluralism, the free and open ability to practice various kinds of legitimate, helpful systems of medicine within our culture, and then over time allow an organic integration to occur, wherein ideas can be exchanged, in some cases combined, in other cases working in a complementary fashion. And then slowly, slowly, over a period of time, we can see what new things occur. That's called human creativity and human invention, as opposed to simply trying to create a product, integrative medicine, which sort of puts a lot of elements in a pot. Now, don't get me wrong. Integrative medicine is a worthwhile thing as it exists, and it helps a lot of people. But I'm just always concerned about language and understanding and the extent to which people know what it is they're getting and what it is perhaps they still need or are losing by thinking only in one narrow fashion.
Yeah, and what you're talking about is more an integration of varying worldviews, not the fitting of different complete systems into one worldview, in this case, you know, biomedicine.
Exactly.
Absorbing
and And it's really the way, you know, science and all aspects of human culture develop. I mean, you know, nowadays this term cultural appropriation is a sort of hot ticket, rather hot button item for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that has meaning. But at the same time, human culture is all about what anthropologists call reciprocal sharing, what other people, which in fact, or to some extent over time, have been appropriation in various forms. But nevertheless, music, food, religion, medicine, all these aspects of human culture, for the most part, had to do with an exchange.
Yes.
And in some places, like along the Silk Road, exchange was very, active.
Mm-hmm.
In other places, exchange happened in slower or in other kinds of ways. And in some isolated areas, things tended to, you know, come to fruition in other fashions. But, you know, human history, human culture, human existence is about having a multitude of ideas, having a multitude of science, having a multitude of experience and inspiration, and then being able to share. So having a sort of pluralistic aspect of culture, and then being able to share and create new things and invent new things. And that's something we have to maintain, especially now when things like intellectual property rights laws and copyright laws try to impinge on that very centuries and centuries and centuries old practice of human beings, wherein heritage or culture or knowledge are increasingly becoming thought of as property, which they're frankly not.
Yes. Can you speak a little bit about the unique worldview of Tibetan medicine, Soa Rigpa, sort of some of the lenses that it views wellness and disease through?
Yeah. Sure. When we think about traditional Asian medicine systems like Tibetan medicine compared to modern medicine, we have to first think about, well, how are they the same and how are they different? Because it's easy to understand things that are the same because it relates to what we know. So the way that they're the same is, for the most part, everybody in medicine is interested in the substances the organs and the systems of the human body. They're depicted somewhat differently, they're thought of somewhat differently, but, you know, the heart, the kidney, the blood, the nervous system, everybody in medicine is interested in this. In traditional Asian medicine, and particularly in Tibetan medicine or Soro Rikpa, we think also, or in one way you could say first or primarily about, you know, what is health? Now, although I'm not in any way opposed to or negatively inclined towards biomedicine, biomedicine is a very powerful and useful system, in my opinion. It has certain strengths and weaknesses like any system of knowledge. And in biomedicine, there isn't really a coherent definition of health. If you look in a biomedical dictionary, you don't see much of a coherent definition of health. If you look at the World Health Organization's definition of health, which is very detailed and very poetic almost, to try to quantify that in biomedical terms could be quite challenging. But in Tibetan medicine, in Soro Rikpa, in other forms of traditional Asian medicine, we start with this idea of what is health, what is normal, what is the normative functioning of the human body. And to do that, we have to first think about the principles upon which those systems, organs, and structures are based, how they come into being in the first place, what causes the what is normal function, what causes them to function normally in the first place. And therefore, when you get to the point of, you know, ill health or illness or disease, you know, what has occurred? What is the cause of that? What is the process? And so in Tibetan medicine, because our system is, as I mentioned, influenced by the Indian system primarily, we tend to think there are three principles of function in the way the body works. And they're defined, these three systems are called Nyepa in Tibetan, and the names of them are Lung, Jipa, and Peyin. These are often sort of mistranslated, frankly, as wind, bile, and phlegm, but let's say Lung, Jipa, and Peyin. To take a very, very vast subject and boil it down into its basic components, Lung is the principle of movement. So it's the movement of anything, whether it's the movement of matter or physical things like blood or nutrition in the body, movement of true energy in the body. You know, nowadays energy is a word used to describe almost everything, but true energy. So, for example, the way the nervous system functions.
Mm-hmm.
And then the movement of things that are thought of as largely insubstantial in a modern context, things that people tend to just call energy freely, but things like thoughts moving in the mind or certain other physical principles that people know of by names like chi or prana or other such, principles of life. So this is Lung. This is the first principle. And then, like all of the three Nyepa or principles, these are broken further into five subcategories and then into further categories. So it's, a very fast subject.
Mm-hmm.
The second principle, Tripa, is based on the principle of heat. And those who are familiar at all with Chinese medicine and Ayurveda have some sense of this idea of, in traditional medicine, how the idea of hot and cold are very important. Hot and cold functions, hot and cold illnesses, etc. And the influence of hot and cold environments on the body. So what is the principle of heat? Well, to start off with your listeners, it's very easy. When I say heat, everyone in your audience understands exactly what I mean, because the quantitative aspect of heat is something we're all familiar with, right?
Yes.
But we also, because we know about the physical component of heat, whether we think about it or not, we're aware of the qualitative, the other aspect of heat, what heat does.
Mm.
So again, making a very vast subject very simple. For example, heat transforms things, right?
Right.
Heat rises, heat expands. I mean, we're moving into the summer, and so we'll see a lot of manifestations of heat on our bodies, on the environment, on the infrastructure of, you know, places we're living, etc. The other creatures and sentient beings that are around us. And so heat, also, we know in the human body, if you have too much heat, you can't survive. If you don't have sufficient heat, you can't survive. So it's an important principle of function.
Right.
Things like metabolism, things like functioning of the liver and the creation of blood are to a large extent influenced by this principle of function. And like the whole discussion of global warming, there's some people who are denying it or claiming, well, there's no global warming because it still snows. You know, when we're talking about heat, we're not talking about merely, again, that explicit quantitative expression of heat where you feel hot. we're talking about heat again, in this quantitative term, but also in this qualitative, or how it expresses itself and how it acts, okay?
Yes.
The final component, Begin, is the principle of cold. And so a lot, having already explained about the principle of heat, your audience understands a lot about what I'm going to say about the principle of cold. There's the physical aspect, which is easy. Everyone understands when I say cold what it means, the qualitative, what the principle of cold enables, or what the physics of cold is. Again, to simplify it, the way, for example, the body maintains its integrity, its physical structures, its fluids, et cetera, are also dictated by this principle. To give just a quick example, the way food is initially broken down when one eats it is akin to that.
Mm-hmm.
Also, in Tibetan medicine, because mind and body are thought to be not connected but interdependent, these principles also have an effect or have a relationship to states of mind, states of mental health, as well as, most importantly, of course, the normal functioning of mind. So, for example, if you're talking about heat, it relates to, on one hand, the ability of people to have a good quality of discriminating intellect, and its excess, things like anger and aggression. In terms of cold, again, to give simple examples, on its positive side, to have a positive sense of will. On its negative side, what to say when people become phlegmatic and sluggish and confused, that's a kind of expression of an excess of this principle in terms of affecting the mind. So anyway, this is a kind of way that traditional medical science works, is that we're most familiar with modern science, which its main function is quantitative, how big, how small, how fast, mm-hmm. You go to your doctor, there's a lot of measurement of things. It's reductionist and it's mechanistic. That's modern medicine. Traditional medicine tended to be, I think, more in qualitative terms initially, and trying to define the nature of things. So, for example, the modern physics has 400 and some odd elements in its chart. In traditional medicine, depending on the system, there's usually four or five elements described. And that's not because traditional people were somehow, missing the other 400 and so, but more because what they were trying to define were the nature or qualities of things that exist in the natural world.
Yes.
And they were able to, in various systems, define, like I say, four or five of these qualities. And within those qualities, they're broken down again further into subcategories, and we could understand a lot. Same like in medicine, the principle of lung is thought to be related exactly to its similar principle of movement in the natural world. The principle of qipa is related to...
That's a train going by. That's okay.
I figured. The principle of heat. See, there's movement.
So, movement and heat.
Movement and heat. That's right. Of heat and fire as it exists in the natural world. The principle of Begin, or cold, relates to the element of water and earth. And so again, by creating this epistemology of analysis, epistemology of knowledge, you can sort of start to critically, evaluate and understand those things that make up the external environment, mm-hmm. the natural world, natural law, and the extent to which the human body is a component of natural law. What are the unique principles and functions that occur in the human body? How are those normally functioning, as I said, in health? And then, if problems occur, what is the nature of those problems? Why are they occurring? What is the source? And then once the illness occurs, of course, we analyze it in a very different way than in biomedicine, based on that kind of system.
Can you say somewhat, again, just for time, in a very simple fashion,
please,
how Tibetan medicine, how Soa Rigpa would define or conceptualize wellness or health?
Well, Soa Rigpa, or Tibetan medicine, is related to the Buddhist understanding that's very predominant in Tibetan culture, which originated in India. And so it's thought that all illness, in some sense or in a large sense, originates in the mind. In other words, the extent to which, I'm sorry, well, health or illness. So the extent to which we can properly perceive our life in its proper context and relate to the world as it is based on natural law and certain spiritual and other principles, one can maintain, you know, health in a more reasonable fashion. Now, of course, we all struggle with this. And so once we get affected by our natural human being, natural tendency to be affected by materialism or attachment, by things like aggression or anger or frustration, hatred, what have you, by ignorance, which is a big discussion in America nowadays, this idea of what's real and what's fake and what's knowledge and what's not. We start to do a number of things which negatively affect both our mental and physical health. Those so-called poisons that are depicted in the Buddhist system, materialism or attachment, aggression, etc., and ignorance, are directly related to the basic principles which I previously discussed.
The nyepa.
Lung is related very much to attachment. Tripa is related very much to forms of aggression. And Pegan to ignorance. And so we could see that, for example, let's take a few examples. If our mind becomes disturbed by, let's say, the great American pastime nowadays is stress, for example, mm-hmm. then this will have an effect on the body. We can develop psychosomatic illnesses. We can develop anxiety, depression, other kinds of conditions. Conversely, if we don't take care of our body properly, if we don't sleep enough, if we overwork, if we expose our body to the environment in an unnatural way or create stresses that the body can't bear, we could create physical illnesses, and those physical illnesses then could also affect the mind.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So there's, from a Tibetan medicine standpoint or a Soa Rigpa standpoint, really a direct relationship between our moment-to-moment ability to understand and work with our thoughts, to deal with our life in a reasonable fashion, whether it be in terms of the way we relate to our environment, the way we relate to people around us, our behavior in various forms, the extent to which our diet serves our unique physical type and the environment that we're in, the season that we're in, and the development of disturbances in proper physical function. And when those disturbances occur, if they're not understood, if they're not properly attended to by ourselves, these can develop into essentially illnesses.
Mm-hmm. Can you discuss how a patient would access traditional Tibetan medicine? You can discuss traditionally how a person might do that, but maybe more to the point, you know, you are in private practice. You can
yes.
Tell us a little bit about that and really describe what's a consultation like? What kinds of things are assessed or asked of the patient? And then what types of treatments might they expect to be given?
Okay. Well, you know, typically when one visits a Tibetan medicine doctor, such as myself, the initial job of the doctor, let's say, is to observe the patient. When you study medicine, and frankly, that's even true of biomedical doctors, you're to some extent trained in recognizing certain outward physical forms. In Tibetan medicine, this is perhaps a more important study and understanding. And, you know, your listeners have to understand, because most people, at least in the States, really have very little understanding of how biomedicine works, mm-hmm. even though they see their doctor quite a bit. Almost how medicine works overall, but, you know, medicine is always a kind of deductive process, okay? Like Sherlock Holmes, let's say, right? So, you know, if anyone who's sort of seen Sherlock Holmes in the movies or read the books, you know, he was very famous. When the person would walk in the room, they'd immediately sort of be able to tell them all kinds of information about themselves. And to some extent, that's also part of what being a good doctor is. So the patient comes in, and then one must observe the patient, various aspects, their complexion, how they walk, their age, how they speak, so on and so on and so forth, and you make certain kinds of decisions from that. The second component of the consultation is talking to the patient. Now, traditionally, many doctors in Asia and in Tibetan medicine, the consultation is fairly brief, but honestly, my teacher, Trogar Rinpoche, was very much a believer in interaction with the patient. And I also believe very much in this. And so we talk to the patient. We try to understand something about their current condition, their current symptoms, any medical treatments they've had, and any pertinent aspects of history, of course. Then we have the diagnostic component. Now, one thing that's often missed in modern society is the extent to which, you know, science and technology and inquiry has always existed among human beings in the modern world as well as in the ancient world. And so these diagnostic practices have developed through these various systems of traditional medicine. But in Tibetan medicine, we rely on first a kind of pulse taking, which those of your audience who've met Chinese medicine doctors or Ayurvedic doctors are a bit familiar with. The doctor presses three fingers of his or her hand to the radial artery of each wrist. And in Tibetan medicine, there's a specific location for this, which is a bit different than in Chinese medicine. And then each finger is divided in half, or the doctor's finger is divided in half. And each half side of the finger, the inner and outer side of the finger, feel for a distinct pulse. So there are 12 pulses altogether that we feel for. Mm-hmm. And each pulse position represents a specific organ of the body. Then we have a kind of urinalysis we do, which is not obviously a laboratory urinalysis. It's Tibetan medicine's a pre-technological system, but a kind of observation test. It's a test also we see done in both the Greek and Persian systems of medicine. And let's say for those of your audience who are not familiar with Unani or the Persian system, this is from largely associated with the Muslim world. You know, you could read writers like Avicenna or Maimonides, and they practices of this system. And you see this kind of urinalysis system that's used. And the idea is that, you know, urine is a byproduct of various physiological functions. It's a waste product. And if you know how to look at it, there's a lot of information that's there because it's moved through the entire system and come out as this waste product. And it's a fact, you know, when you look at a urine sample, you look at a large factor of components, the color, the viscosity, the extent to which there are any deposits in the sample, obviously the smell, the way in which bubbles are formed and are affected by agitation, any deposits that are either on the surface or within the sample, and on and on and on. There are lots of different factors that are understood. And similarly with the pulses, there are many different factors, the depth of the pulse, the breadth of the pulse, the rapidity of the pulse, and lots of other qualities one has to learn. Then, of course, there are other additional things that a doctor can do. There are points in the body you could press to find out about sensitivities, and those points relate to specific organs or functions. One tends to look at the eyes, the sclera of the eye, the white part of the eye, again, to look for many signs in, that help with diagnosis. And then finally, a tongue diagnosis. One looks at the tongue, and again, there are very many signs, deposits on the tongue, the color of the tongue, the shape of the tongue, on and on and on. And so, like with any kind of medicine, like with modern medicine, what one tends to do is to first collect information. And you collect as much information as you can and need to collect. And then you know, through education, medical education, and then deduction, decide what kind of diagnosis you think is there. And if you're not sure, you ask more questions, of course, but you decide on the kind of diagnosis. Or the nature of the disease, really. And based on that, one can define what kind of solutions should be employed. And those solutions in Tibetan medicine, as I sort of implied previously, first have to do with changes in behavior. And behavior is a big subject, obviously, whether it's exercise or mental view or relationships or mm-hmm. whether one meditates or not or various many things that have to do with behavior, sleeping patterns, etc. Then diet. Diet is very essential. You know, I talked earlier about this friend of mine who I'd helped initially, mm-hmm. and the very severe illness she had, and the extent to which this severe illness was helped to a large extent simply by dietary medicine. And so there are limitations to it. People shouldn't assume that just because, you know, if they have an illness, you know, diet could always cure it or could cure it readily. It's very much an issue of applying the right treatment or solution to the right problem, and one shouldn't exclude biomedical approaches where they're necessary. But diet is an incredibly powerful and significant tool in healthcare and in the treatment of illness. Then in Tibetan medicine, of course, Tibetan medicine is an enormous pharmacopoeia of herbal medicines that we use, herbal compounds that we use. This is a century-old system based, as I said, on the inspirations historically that I mentioned, and then filtered through the experience of centuries of practice of Tibetan medicine doctors. And based on the various regions that Tibetan medicine has been practiced in Tibet, in Mongolia, in Siberia, in Russia, in Poland, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, doctors have also had this bioregional approach of using the text as the basis for their formulas, but then researching botanically plants that were available locally and combine them with plants that were imported from, or be India or the Himalayas or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a wide range of physical therapies in Tibetan medicine, somewhat similar to some of the other Asian systems of medicine, moxibustion or applying heat to specific points of the body, other kinds of ways of producing heat through using certain tools to create friction or pressure, also a system of acupuncture that's unique to Tibetan medicine, massage, of course, and other kinds of physical treatments. And so, like any, you know, medical system, it has a wide-ranging approach to theory, physiology, pathology, and this approach to how to create applications for various kinds of problems.
That's great. We're coming down on the hour. We have about 7 minutes left, and I want to specifically ask you to tell our listeners both sort of, you've got some stuff coming up with how you will be helping bring Soa Rigpa to traditional Tibetan medicine to region, and anything you care to say about that, and your private practice as well, of course, how people can get in touch with you.
I've been working with colleagues to help develop a program that's been perpetuated internationally by a Tibetan doctor from Eastern Tibet, Dr. Nida Chenaksong. He's been teaching and traveling to countries in Europe and Asia and now in North America to teach about Soa Rigpa or Tibetan medicine. And a group here has been formed to try to, act as an anchor for this educational project. And we have an organization called Soa Rigpa, New York. And
Or did we change it to New York City now?
New York City.
Yes.
Sorigkhang. Sorigkhang. That's basically in Tibetan means house of medicine. NYC. And you could look on Facebook. I think the Facebook page still says Sorigkhang, New York. But nevertheless, you can find it. And this is a project that's been initiated, and over time we'll be developing educational programs and hopefully some other kinds of programs to help sick people. And folks can look on the Facebook page. And
Elliot is the primary teacher and director of educational programs for Soa Rigpa.
Yeah, I'll be doing some teaching there. We'll hopefully bring some other folks in as well. As far as my own practice, people should feel free to look on TibetanMedicine.com. On the internet, and I apologize in advance for a sort of a website that's sort of just been long-standing and not quite up to date, but nevertheless, all the information, in fact, today I was looking at the site, and I realized one of the reasons I haven't updated much is all the information on it is actually correct. the editorials are still right, for good or ill, the explanations are still pretty firm, and on the clinical resources page, you could see my email address, my phone number, times to call if one wants to set up individual clinical appointments, and I'm happy to consult with anybody and help them to the extent to which Tibetan medicine and I can.
That's terrific. And things you've written are available at links on the website as well. And do you have
some of that? But let me just say that, you know, they could also, you know, if they just put Elliot Tokar, ElliotTokar, on Google, you'll find lots of material. One of the places that you could find a lot of my publications, I've published in academic and medical journals, is on independent.academia.edu. And most of my publications are available to read there. So independent.academia.edu. nyu.edu/Eliot Tokar, or like I said, just put my name into Google and you could see lots of things to read and to educate yourself about Tibetan medicine, Soro Rigpa. And we're happy to have any conversations with people about education through the Sorokang New York. And let me say, the Sorokang New York, we have a great team. Sarah, of course, who's our interviewer here, host on the show. It was great experience as a massage therapist and artist and activist, a very knowledgeable woman. And Lama Justin von Boydash, who's the current New York City Department of Corrections chaplain, is a Western Lama and quite a brilliant fellow also. And I think we have a very good group who can really bring some of this ancient knowledge into the modern context of New York in a way that will be of value to folks.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. So folks, we'll also be posting all of these links on the Facebook page for Roots Runners Rhizome, so you can just click through to find Eliot and Sorokang New York. And you can consult with Eliot. What's the process? Do people just get in touch with you and book appointment and then for a consult?
Yes, they would, exactly. Mm-hmm. They would, you know, call me. Should I give the number on the
Yeah, you can say the number. Yeah.
Oh, okay. They could call me during business hours, please. in the Eastern time zone, Eastern Standard Time, at 718-641-7323, and book an appointment. And I see patients in Manhattan, in New York City, and I'm happy to book an appointment for you or to speak to you about your health concerns. Of course, you know. We're trying to really both, perpetuate, preserve, and create progress in this ancient system of medicine. And what is the goal of medicine? Really only one thing, which is to help suffering and to help people who are in some way trying to improve or fix their health. That's the goal of medicine. And this is what we're trying to do.
That's terrific. Thank you so much, Eliot. And listeners, Lauren Gemperney will be back in July. July, we will be having Rob Bouillon back on the show to unpack whatever legislation has been invented or implemented or inflicted upon us regarding American healthcare. That's again the fourth Monday of the month in July. So we'll see you then. In the meantime, look for us on Facebook. And thanks for listening. And thanks, Eliot Tokar.
Thank you.
Have
a great day. Thank you, listeners. Bye.
Bye.